content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward with the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the March 3rd, 2023 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week has what looks to be a teenage girl sitting on the floor in the in a darkened room. She's got her back against the wall, her arms folded across her knees and her head and her arms. She's wearing jeans and sneakers and a plaid shirt. On the floor beside her is a smartphone. Looks like it's upside down, but it's casting a glow upward. The headline is An Epidemic of Anguish, Why Depression and Despair Are Soaring Among Teen Girls. And we'll read that story with the controversy of the week, but we'll start with the main stories. First up, Biden in Kyiv vows unwavering support. What happened? President Biden made a daring and dramatic show of support for Ukraine this week with a surprise visit to Kyiv and a speech in Poland where he vowed that support from the U.S. and its allies will not waver. On the cusp of the war's first anniversary, Biden arrived in Kyiv after a long clandestine trip that required him to leave Washington on an Air Force jet in pre-dawn darkness, land in Poland, and travel to the Ukrainian capital via a 10-hour train ride. He spent 5 hours in Kyiv meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, visiting the U.S. Embassy, and walking along the Wall of Remembrance War Memorial amid the sound of air raid sirens. Biden, the first U.S. president to travel to a war zone not occupied by U.S. forces, pledged to soon release another $500 million in military aid. Russian President Vladimir Putin thought Ukraine was weak and the West was divided, Biden said while standing shoulder to shoulder with Zelensky. But he was dead wrong. 1 year later, Kyiv stands, and Ukraine stands. Democracy stands. A day later, in a speech in front of thousands outside of Warsaw's royal castle, Biden warned of hard and bitter days ahead and a war he cast as a battle between freedom and autocracy. With evident anger, the president accused Russia of war crimes, including using rape as a weapon of war, abducting Ukrainian children, and bombing hospitals and schools. Russian forces have committed crimes against humanity without shame or compunction, Biden said. In a speech to the Russian parliament, Putin signaled that Russians should dig in for a protracted conflict. He cast Russia not as an invader, but as a victim of the decadent West's intrusion into former Soviet republics. The West started the war, he said. We used force and continue to use it to stop it. What the editorial said. Democracy stands in Ukraine, said the Minneapolis Star Tribune, and that outcome is due in no small measure to Biden. He's rallied allies from the free world to come to Ukraine's defense, strengthened NATO's unity and resolve, and won bipartisan support from most members of Congress. Where the war goes from here will determine the geopolitical order in the near term and perhaps beyond. Putin's bellicose speech made clear that seeking a peace settlement is a fantasy, said the Wall Street Journal. That gives the West a stark choice. Give Ukraine the weapons to win or abandon Ukraine and live with the fallout for decades. Biden hit all the right notes in Kyiv, but he's still holding back the fighter jets and the long-range surface-to-surface missiles that Ukraine urgently needs to strike deeper into Russian positions and turn the tide of the war. Political support for the war could fray in Washington and Europe if it drags on. What the columnist said. Biden's trip took guts, said Mark Antonio Wright in National Review. With neither U.S. nor Ukraine in full control of the airspace, there was genuine risk involved. And the symbolism was deeply meaningful. No one should be under any illusion about the power of an American president going into a war zone to offer a beleaguered nation our unflagging support. The scale of Putin's folly is stunning, said David Remnick in The New Yorker. A year after he invaded, confident of a quick victory, his hapless army has suffered catastrophic casualties of as many as 200,000 soldiers. The Ukrainians, he underestimated, are unified in their resolve and hatred of Russia, and Russia is isolated and economically weakened. But Putin cannot afford to lose, so this catastrophic war could go on for a very long time. Putin's primary goal now is to extend the war until the West tires of supporting Ukraine, said Dara Massicott in the New York Times. His military strategy has been reduced to a campaign of brute force and repetitive attacks that use barely trained troops as cannon fodder. When Ukrainians reveal their positions as they mow down these charging soldiers, Russia's army responds with withering artillery fire. Putin has made it clear he will sacrifice endless numbers of troops and mortgage Russia's future to achieve what he can. But this week, Biden hit Putin with a gut punch, said Elliot A. Cohen in The Atlantic. A leader obsessed with strength, Putin had to watch impotently while his American nemesis, wearing his signature aviator sunglasses, strolled Kyiv with his arm around the pugnacious and eloquent Zelensky, shaking hands and slapping backs. Putin's own people have to be asking, why could we not prevent this? The end of this pivotal conflict is still unwritten, but with his bold act of statesmanship, Biden has sent a strong message to Putin and made the future of Ukraine look a great deal brighter. Our second main story is rural Ohioans demand action on toxic spill. What happened? Nearly 3 weeks after a train derailment unleashed the toxic chemical vinyl chloride in East Palestine, Ohio, state and federal officials sought to reassure residents that their air and water was safe. Since the 141-car train derailed on February 3rd, residents in the town of about 5,000 people have complained of ailments ranging from nausea and rashes to difficulty breathing. Ohio officials this week opened a dedicated health clinic to treat those who fear their symptoms are related to the accident, while the Centers for Disease Control sent a team of experts. Also this week, the Environmental Protection Agency ordered the train company, Norfolk Southern, to conduct and pay for all necessary cleanup of the area's soil and water. This order represents one of EPA's strongest authorities to hold a company accountable for jeopardizing a community's health and safety, said EPA Administrator Michael Regan. To express confidence in the safety of the town's tap water, both Regan and Ohio Governor Mike DeWine publicly drank a glassful. Local officials complained that Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg didn't come to the town to see the damage until this week, days after former President Donald Trump visited, while President Biden hadn't come at all. East Palestine Mayor Trent Conaway said no one from the White House had even reached out to him until almost 2 weeks after the derailment. Buttigieg blamed the disaster on the gutting of EPA regulations under Trump, saying the weakening of rules governing toxic transport had set the stage for an accident. He said his department would inspect routes used for carrying hazardous materials and admitted he could have spoken sooner about the incident. What the editorial said. Frightened Ohioans are asking whether they or their children are going to get cancer, said the Cleveland Plain Dealer. And they deserve better transparency from all levels of government. In future accidents, rail companies should be required to immediately disclose details of everything aboard derailed trains, so officials know what the hazards are. For now, Norfolk Southern should be forced to keep monitoring the air, water, and soil in the spill zone for years to come. Only that will ease residents' anxieties and empower them to take action to address any long-term effects. The fiasco proves that the louder they shout about the little guy, the less Dems will actually do for them, said the New York Post. The accident could have been an opportunity for Biden and Buttigieg to show leadership and score easy political points simply by owning the situation, committing to reforms, and then helping out in a highly visible way. Instead, they spent far too long flipping those pathetic flyover rubes a massive bird. What the columnist said. The accident struck a region where people already believe they're treated as expendable, said Daniel McGraw in The Bulwark. The town is on the border between Ohio and Pennsylvania, swing states heavily impacted by the opioid crisis and the loss of manufacturing jobs. When the train derailed, officials chose to burn the toxic contents first to clear the tracks and then assess the severity. It looked like the sort of decision that favors the trains more than the people, and it will only add to the frustration of the small-town rural electorate that plays such a big role in today's politics. The toxic spill wasn't some random life-imitating art manifestation of Don DeLillo's classic novel White Noise, said David Sirota in the New York Times. There are 1,000 derailments every year, proof of just how dangerous America's rail industry has become. That's at least partly due to the deregulation that occurred during the Obama and Trump administrations. The industry successfully lobbied against stricter rules for trains carrying flammable chemicals and against better brakes. And now we have too many preventable derailments. The government took a toxic risk in erring on the side of efficiency versus safety, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. The same precision-scheduled railroading methods that caused last year's labor dispute among rail workers also gave us longer and heavier freight trains with fewer people on the job making sure they operate safely. That may work out well for rail profits, but for desperate residents of East Palestine, Ohio, not so much. And the controversy of the week. Teen girls, an epidemic of despair. American teens are mired in a state of emotional catastrophe, said Maura Donegan in The Guardian. A CDC report released last week paints a deeply disturbing picture of the mental health of high schoolers. Among the more than 17,000 teens surveyed in 2021, 42% said they experienced persistent feelings of sadness or hopelessness. The malaise is far more widespread than in a similar survey in 2011 and affects both genders. But in nearly every measure, girls are faring dramatically worse. A majority of girls, 57%, reported persistent despair versus 29% of boys. Nearly one in three girls seriously considered suicide, up from 19% in 2011, and 13% say they attempted it in the past year. 14% of girls report being raped in the past year, a horrifying increase of 27% since just 2019. This is an emergency, one that is worsening. What caused this misery, asked John Gabriel in the Arizona Republic. The CDC offered no definitive answer, but consider what has happened over the past decade. Instagram was released in late 2010, Snapchat in 2011, TikTok in 2016. Soon thereafter, 90% of teen girls reported using social media every day. These apps, which put a premium on selfies and videos, create more social comparison, social pressure, and negative peer interactions with teens measuring their self-worth or lack of it in likes and followers. Then in 2020, COVID-19 entered the picture, pushing school onto Zoom and leaving teens texting with friends or doom-scrolling alone in their bedrooms. Actually, there's not much evidence of a COVID effect, said Jonathan Haidt in jonathanhaidtsubstack.com. By the time schools shut their doors, teens had already lost most of their social lives to their phones. Before social media apps, teens spent about 2 hours a day hanging out with friends in person. Then social media ushered in a new phone-based childhood. Smartphones take time away from sleep, play, and in-person socializing, as well as drown kids in social comparisons they can't win. Research shows that social media is addictive, said Jessica Carl in Bloomberg, especially for teens with limited impulse control. They spend hours a day studying the posts and videos of celebrities, friends, and strangers, setting up expectations that are prison for a 13-year-old's brain, constantly reminding them of their fragility hasn't helped, said Kristen Fleming in the New York Post. Teens are bombarded with media that tells them that the world is a hellscape of racism, mass shootings, and microaggressions, that language is violence, and that if they somehow survive to adulthood, climate change will deal them a death blow. With adults mired in pessimism and fear, no wonder these kids are paralyzed by anxiety. Whatever its root causes, the epidemic of hopelessness should be considered a national crisis, said Derek Thompson in The Atlantic. Did the reopening of schools and social spaces this year help reduce teens' anguish? The CDC survey comes out only every other year, so we'll have to wait to find out. Clearly, though, modern internet culture and its emphasis on physical beauty, conflict, and catastrophizing has become toxic for teens. In the open expanse of the internet, we could have built any kind of world. We built this one. Why have we done this to ourselves? Time for our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for Japan. After a new cartographic survey of the archipelago nation will roughly double its number of islands to more than 14,000. Previous surveys neglected to count small islands in lakes and rivers, and new islands have been created by volcanic activity. It was a good week for smells, with a proposal from State Senator Bill Soles to make the aroma of green chili roasting in the fall the official state aroma of New Mexico, making it the first state with an official aroma. It was a good week for honesty after Representative George Santos was asked in an interview why he thought he could get away with telling so many lies while running for Congress. I ran in 2020 for the same exact seat, and I got away with it then, Santos said. But it was a bad week for irreconcilable differences after Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene said that because of the sick and disgusting woke culture of blue states, red states must go out on their own. We need a national divorce, Greene declared. Everyone I talk to says this. It was a bad week for Florida, whose coastal waters and beaches could be enveloped this summer by an unprecedented 8.7 million tons of seaweed, or sargassum, currently forming in the Atlantic east of Cuba. The massive mat of seaweed smells like rotten eggs as it decays. Finally, it was a bad week for returns. After passengers on an Air New Zealand flight flew halfway from Auckland to New York, only to have the plane make a U-turn back to Auckland because of a terminal closure at JFK Airport. After flying 16 hours to go nowhere, passengers were reportedly boiling with annoyance and anger. The briefing this week is titled, Attacking the Grid. Domestic terrorism targeting the U.S. electric grid is exposing dangerous vulnerabilities. Why is the grid at risk? Domestic terrorists and vandals have found it to be alarmingly easy to trigger blackouts in the vast, decentralized network of 55,000 power substations and millions of miles of transmission wires that provide America's electricity. There were more than 100 attacks on U.S. electrical infrastructure last year, a 72% increase over 2021. The end of 2022 saw a spate of attacks in the Carolinas, Washington State, and Oregon. In Moore County, North Carolina, three attackers, who remain at large, shot up a pair of substations, causing 45,000 residents to lose power for up to 5 days. Watching life grind to a halt as people sat in the darkness was like something out of a horror movie, said Representative Ben Moss, Jr. White supremacists are believed to be behind many of the latest attacks. Recently, two neo-Nazi connected to a group called the Adam Waffen Division allegedly plotted to destroy five substations around Baltimore, hoping to cause cascading failure in the electric system serving the majority black city. This type of sabotage, along with the growing risk of grid cyber attacks, creates real peril as Americans become increasingly dependent on electricity. How are the attacks carried out? Substations convert electricity from power plants to higher and lower voltages so it can be distributed to consumers. The giant transformers that do this work are cooled with circulating oil, and recently some attackers have simply driven up to a substation and blasted holes in these metal boxes with rifles, springing oil leaks that cause the transformers to overheat. Vital regional substations usually are protected by armed guards and bullet-resistant barriers, but thousands of other substations across the country, plus wind turbines and solar plants, are in remote rural areas, secured by little more than chain-link fences. Some don't even have surveillance cameras. What about cyber attacks? Security experts have warned for years that the grid is vulnerable to hackers. Those fears were realized in 2021 when a ransomware cyber attack caused the temporary shutdown of the Colonial Pipeline, which provides nearly half of the East Coast's oil. The pipeline reopened only after the anonymous hackers received a $4.4 million bribe. Globally, the energy industry was the third most targeted sector for cyber attacks in 2020, after finance and manufacturing, up from the ninth place a year earlier, according to IBM. For more than a decade, Russia and the U.S. reportedly have each sought to make digital incursions into the other's electric grid, planting probes that could disable power plants and trigger blackouts if a conflict escalated. Why are attacks on the rise? On far-right internet forums, commenters gloat about how attacking the grid cracked the code on lone wolf attacks, with one user writing, "Law enforcement appears powerless, no pun intended, to stop them. Disabling a single transformer usually causes a localized blackout, but if several substations fail at once, it can trigger cascading outages." Federal report published in 2014 found that strategically disabling just nine substations across the country, combined with an attack on a transformer manufacturer, could cause a nationwide blackout lasting 18 months. In modern society, a blackout doesn't just cause the lights to go out, of course. It can also cripple wastewater treatment, heating and cooling, personal banking, home security, the charging of electrical vehicles, and so much else. The Department of Homeland Security warns that violent extremists view attacks on electrical systems as a means to create chaos and advance ideological goals. What are their goals? White supremacists believe modern American society is in terminal decline and seek to hasten its collapse so a fascist government can rise from the ashes, a movement they called accelerationism. A neo-Nazi group recently published a 250-page manual online for attacking the grid, with a swastika and lightning bolts on the cover. The guide details vulnerabilities at cell towers, power grids, and other infrastructure. When the lights don't come back on, all hell will break loose, it reads, making conditions desirable for our race to once again take back what is ours. In 2020, the FBI foiled a plot called Lights Out, created by three members of the Adam Waffen Division. They allegedly planned to simultaneously attack substations across the country, hoping months of blackouts would lead to a race war and economic collapse. Why is security so weak? No single authority is in charge of setting security standards for the grid. Instead, that responsibility falls on a collection of regional public and private utilities, many of which balk at the cost of paying for 24/7 armed guards or tall concrete walls at every substation. Responding to recent attacks, legislators in North Carolina, South Carolina, Arizona, and Georgia proposed bills that would require round-the-clock substation guards and impose tougher penalties on attackers. Brian Harrell, a former Homeland Security Assistant Secretary for Infrastructure Protection, predicts this year will be the most catastrophic on record for violent extremists targeting U.S. electricity infrastructure. There's no doubt in my mind, he said. And we'll read several of the best columns of the week, starting with the GOP's performance artists. Republicans have been shamelessly lying to voters about election fraud, vaccines, and climate change, said Jennifer Rubin. So it's little surprise they are now increasingly lying about themselves. Representative George Santos, the Republican from New York, wears the crown for fabricating virtually his entire life. But he has plenty of company in the party of charlatans. Former President Donald Trump lied continuously, and his hand-picked U.S. Senate candidate from Georgia, Herschel Walker, compulsively lied during his campaign about everything. Now Santos and Walker are joined by Representatives Anna Paulina Luna, Republican from Florida, and Andrew Ogles from Tennessee, who have also concocted bogus backgrounds. Luna, whose grandfather fought for Nazi Germany, changed her name from Meyerhofer before running for Congress, and has alternately claimed to be Jewish, Middle Eastern, and Mexican-American. Ogles, meanwhile, has claimed to be an economist, a police officer, and an international sex crimes expert. All false. Republicans believe their Fox News base will buy anything, including biographical fiction. They see politics as performance art, not public service. So the more extravagant the claims they make, whether they are about themselves or the world, the better. Why we need more immigration. Americans are souring on immigration, said Noah Smith. But bringing in new workers for our economy is not charity, it's a necessity. Two-thirds of those polled by Gallup recently said they want less immigration. These sentiments are no doubt largely driven by the huge influx of asylum seekers at the southern border in recent years, and the perception that the federal government is not in control of its own borders. That concern is valid and should be addressed by reform of asylum laws that the Biden administration has already begun. But the reality is that the U.S. badly needs more legal immigration, especially of skilled workers. Our country's birth rate has dropped below the replacement rate, and without young immigrants, the average age of our population will grow older and older. That will reduce our productivity and force too few young workers to support too many retirees. Scientists and engineers from abroad are responsible for 30% of U.S. patents, and highly trained researchers will be critical in our high-stakes digital competition with China. Immigration has always been a core U.S. strength, and in coming decades, young, hardworking newcomers will be essential for America's competitive vitality. Turkey's grim lesson for California. California will be hit one day with a massive earthquake similar to the one that just killed more than 46,000 people in Turkey and Syria, said Rong Gong Lin II. A seismic event in California, like the back-to-back quakes in Turkey, a magnitude 7.8 followed by a 7.5, could rupture the southern San Andreas Fault, from the Mexican border to Los Angeles, with major aftershocks causing damage as far north as San Francisco and Sacramento. The U.S. Geological Survey estimates a 7.8 earthquake on the San Andreas Fault would kill about 1,800 people and injure 50,000, cause $200 billion in damage, destroy freeways, and disrupt electrical, gas, cell phone, and internet service. There will be 7.8s in our future, absolutely, said Caltech, says seismologist Lucy Jones. Lax building standards in Turkey contributed to the devastation, but the greater Los Angeles area still has dozens of older concrete frame and unreinforced brick buildings that could collapse during a major quake. Yet officials have failed to order retrofits. There is an inevitable disaster in California's future, and we should learn from Turkey's tragedy how we can better withstand seismic shocks and reduce loss of life. The last word, our in-depth article, titled this week, The Soul of the Stradivarius. Musicians have treasured Stradivarius violins for three centuries, said journalist Ellie Fishman in Chicago Magazine. John Becker's delicate skill brings out their inimitable sound. It's a few minutes past 10 in the morning, and John Becker stands just inside the door to his company's office in Chicago's downtown Fine Arts building. He wears a black workman's apron, which he fits to his body by wrapping the ties around his torso twice. With his shoulders slightly hunched, he quietly observes the almost surreal scene unfolding before him. A few feet away, Joshua Bell and James Enns, two of the most prominent solo violinists on the planet, hover over an arts and crafts style wood table. Normally, Bell, a former child prodigy known for his virtuosic animated playing, and Enns, a musician's musician celebrated for his technical prowess, would be the superstars in the room. Both have won multiple Grammy Awards, and between the two of them, they have performed in nearly every major concert hall and with all the best orchestras in the world. But here, in Becker's studio inside his office, another icon takes center stage. I'm really nervous and excited, says Bill, his hands stuffed in his pockets. It's like meeting my wife again after 2 months. I'm a little overwhelmed. Oh yeah, I understand the feeling, Enns chimes in, his tone nearly giddy. His eyes are set on an object perched on a gray cloth that covers the tabletop. I've never seen this violin before. It's incredible. It's so beautiful. He pauses, as though to take in every contour. The spruce wood, a swirl of orange and red hues, glows under the morning light. It's stunning. The violin in question belongs to Bell. The 310-year-old instrument, which Bell has said is worth as much as $15 million, is among the roughly 650 made by the renowned 18th-century Italian craftsman Antonio Stradivari that survived today. Bell left it with Becker for repairs, and over the past 2 months, the master luthier applied protective polish to preserve the original varnish, removed the top to make internal repairs, and handcrafted several cleats to reinforce tiny cracks in the wood. Bell has flown in from New York to retrieve the violin, which has been his concert instrument since 2001, before he departs on a tour of South America and Italy. Enns plans to leave his own Stradivarius with Becker for more minor repairs, a bridge adjustment, a varnish touch-up, a new sound post, which will take only a day. The Canadian has made this essential stop before heading to concerts in South Korea and Japan. Becker turns to Bell and asks if he wants to give the violin a try. It may look beautiful thanks to the fresh polish, but after 213 hours of painstaking work, the true test is how it feels and sounds. "Yes, I do," Bell responds, eagerly picking up the instrument. Bell doesn't play violin, but his ears are more attuned. Becker doesn't play violin, but his ears are more attuned to the famed sound of Stradivarius instruments than perhaps anyone else's in the world. He steps back as Bell raises his bow. It's impossible to exaggerate the mythic reputation of Stradivarius violins. Antonio Stradivari is considered one of the two greatest violin makers in history. Giuseppe Guarneri di Gesù, his contemporary in the Italian city of Cremona, is the other. The surviving Strads, celebrated for their lyrical, robust sounds and delicate shape, are prized by collectors, musicians, and historians. Each boasts its own name, like the Messiah, the Ruby, Bell's Gibson, or Enns Marsyk, and all come with a long ledger of previous owners. One, the Molitor, is rumored to have been owned by Napoleon. Coveted in their time, Strads have only gained in esteem and value. There are other luthiers with expertise in instruments from the Italian craftsman's golden period, from 1700 to 1725, but master violin restorers are rare, about 20 worldwide now, and Becker is widely regarded as the best. At 64, he has worked on more than 120 Stradivarius violins, likely more, he says, than any other living person. People travel from all over the globe to hand-deliver their instruments to Becker's office. Musicians visiting John K. Becker and Company take a rickety elevator manned by one of the city's last remaining operators to the 10th floor. The office's vaulted ceilings are a relic of the building's original purpose as a showroom for carriages. On the door is an illustration by Becker's wife, Anne, of a bridge modeled after that of the Medici tenor Viola, likely the lone surviving one crafted by Stradivari. Inside Becker's studio, the sun streams through two skylights, bathing the space in a warm glow. It's quiet, no music, no chatter, just meditative scrapes and strokes of tools at work. The room is divided into three workstations, occupied by Becker and the two Japanese luthiers he has employed since opening the shop 28 years ago. Becker's faded bench, tucked into a corner, is scarred with scratches and a smattering of stains, remnants of projects past. Becker's daily rhythms verge on monastic. He arrives before 8 a.m. after a 90-minute metro ride from his home in the northwest suburbs. He spends most of the day in his chair, hovering over a violin, and takes only two breaks, at noon for lunch and at 3 for a snack. At 4:45, he packs up and leaves to catch a 5:20 train home. On this early August day, a week before the visit from Bell and Inns, Becker sits between his two luthiers, Takeshi Nogawa and Kaisuke Hori. With his sleeves rolled up his forearms, Hori holds a thin cut of wood under a medical-grade microscope. It is, in fact, the top of an 18th-century violin made by the father of Guarneri del Gesù. Three generations of the Guarneri family made violins. The remaining pieces, the back, the ribs, the neck, rest a few inches away. The instrument was brought in a few weeks earlier. The owner told Becker that it had been sitting in a garage for more than a decade after the owner's father retired from professional music. The years of neglect had warped the instrument and left it in desperate need of restoration. Hori examines the disassembled violin closely. As he does, he holds a small brush in his left hand. Hori counts four large cracks around the bridge and sound post, and a few smaller ones scattered across the top. The sides are in even worse shape. "This is a very, very big job," says Becker, looking up from his station. "It's going to be about 1,000 hours of work." Becker used to handle the business side, but that job now belongs to his elder son, John Jr. Though John Jr. never studied woodworking, he grew up playing violin and observing his father's craft. For Becker, the work is an act of historic and cultural preservation. He often points to something David Fulton, a prominent collector of Cremonese stringed instruments, once told him. "We are caretakers of these instruments. We move on. But these instruments continue to the next generation." Despite being perhaps the best of these caretakers, Becker has never actually played a Stradivarius. Growing up in Huntington Beach, California, he was more interested in materials than in music. His junior year, a friend was making a guitar, and Becker decided to give it a try. After graduating from high school, Becker joined the apprentice program at Lyon and Healy, a renowned harp manufacturer, then went to the violin dealer and restoration shop Bine and Fushi in 1979. In 1989, Becker took over as head of the entire workshop, and 5 years later he left to open his own shop just a few doors down the hall. One early Saturday morning, Becker sits at his desk holding a 1694 Stradivarius in one hand and a small metal straight-edge gauge in the other. With his glasses perched on his nose, he brings the instrument under a bright lamp and places the stool in three different spots along the violin's fingerboard. How the fingerboard sits beneath the gauge indicates where it has changed shape under the weight of the owner's fingers. This board, Becker says, has been significantly worn down, as evidenced by several small ridges that give it almost a wave-like texture. It takes Becker only a few seconds to make the assessment, and then he gets to work. Sliding a trimming plane back and forth across the fingerboard in a motion that mirrors an iron gliding across a wrinkled shirt, small ebony shavings begin to gather around the instrument. Becker occasionally pauses to remeasure the board. The secret of Stradivarius sound, powerful, lyrical, and assertive, has been a subject of obsession for musicians, scholars, and alchemists for centuries. One hypothesis posits that Stradivarius used alpine spruce that grew during an uncommonly cold period, which made the wood unusually dense. Another theory focuses on the varnish. Scientists have used 3D lasers and CT scans to measure the precise geometry of Stradivarius, but so far no one has been able to replicate its sound. That doesn't stop contemporary violin makers from trying, Becker's younger son Garrett among them. He builds four instruments a year, each modeled from measurements he takes of the Strads brought to his father, and sells them for $27,000 apiece. Becker's ability to pull the best sound out of Strads carries its own mystery, too. Asked to explain his precise methods, he points to instinct. These instruments have a certain soul. When a soloist brings their instrument in, I don't need them to tell me what's going on. I watch them. I watch their bow. I watch their fingers. People think it's magic, but it's just experience. James Innes has been bringing his Stradivarius to Becker for more than 20 years. As a celebrated solo violinist, he's had the opportunity to play more than 100 Strads, many loaned to him by collectors for concerts or competitions. But when Innes first saw the Marsic in 1996, he knew it was special. Named for its 1960 owner, the Belgian violinist Martin Pierre Joseph Marsic, the instrument disappeared for nearly a century after landing in Russia just before the 1917 revolution. "The Marsic was the only one I couldn't shake," said Innes. "The character spoke to me. I had this feeling that it was going to be really exceptional." Innes, who has played the Marsic for 2 decades, brings the violin to Chicago for maintenance at least once a year. Over time, he and Becker have become close, building a friendship through mutual admiration and a shared reverence for Stradivari's craft. "John just really respects the instrument," says Innes. "He's not trying to put his mark on it. He's trying to let each individual instrument live up to its own potential." Their long partnership is one reason Becker wanted Innes to inaugurate the first bowed instrument the luthier has built from scratch. Becker started working on the instrument, a bench copy of a Carlo Tononi viola, while restoring the original at Bine and Fushi in the 1980s. But he never finished it, as family and professional duties got in the way. Then the pandemic hit. With a near total stop in work, Becker suddenly had a lot of free time, so he decided to pick the project back up. He completed it just a few days before Innes arrived to drop off the Marsic. Back in Becker's office that mid-August day, an hour before Joshua Bell is due to pick up his violin, Innes takes a deep cherry viola from Becker. "I can't tell you how excited I am," said Innes, eyeing the instrument with delight. "This is a moment." "It plays like a little Ferrari," said Becker. "Give it a spin, see what you think." It was a long time in the process. Innes begins to tune the four strings. Once satisfied, he pulls his bow across them and starts to play. After just a few seconds, he stops and looks at Becker, visibly astonished. "The beauty of the core of that sound, you know how rare that is," he says. "You just don't find it. You nailed it. You absolutely nailed it." Becker's mouth curls into a smile and he laughs sheepishly. Sometimes it works out. This was adapted from an article first published in Chicago Magazine. Read one of the obituaries. The catcher who became a star commentator, Tim McCarver, 1941 to 2023. Tim McCarver exemplified why catchers can make excellent broadcasters. More than any other position, catchers have to analyze the game, and McCarver honed that skill in a professional career spanning 4 decades. As a two-time All-Star and two-time World Series champ in 1964 and 67 with the St. Louis Cardinals, in the broadcast booth where he worked 24 World Series, he gave viewers uniquely penetrating insights. In the final at-bat of the 2001 championship, for example, when Arizona Diamondbacks star Luis Gonzalez faced New York Yankees closer Mariano Rivera with one out, the bases loaded and the game tied, McCarver questioned the Yankees for moving their infielders in. "The one problem is Rivera throws inside to left-handers," he said. "Left-handers get a lot of broken bat hits in the shallow part of the outfield." Gonzalez proceeded to hit a series-clinching bloop single just past the infield. McCarver was born in Memphis, the son of a police officer, said ESPN.com. A multi-sport star in high school, he was sought by college football powerhouses but opted for baseball, signing for $75,000. A generous offer for that time, with the Cardinals in 1959, when he was just 17. He reached the big leagues that same year, said the New York Times, and had a career year in 1967, finishing second for the National League's Most Valuable Player Award after hitting .295 with 14 home runs and 69 runs batted in. Superb stats for a catcher of the era. He went on to play with Philadelphia, Montreal, and Boston over his 21 seasons behind the plate. And he was battery mate to two of baseball's greatest pitchers, Bob Gibson and Steve Carlton. McCarver spent 16 seasons as a broadcaster for the New York Mets and went on to join Fox's announcing team as color commentator, said the New York Post. Inducted into the Sports Broadcasting Hall of Fame, McCarver had his share of detractors, from fans who tired of his long-winded explanations to players miffed by his criticism, like Deion Sanders, who once dumped a bucket of water on his head. McCarver wasn't cowed. "There are a few things you never get tired of hearing," he said, "like when your daughters tell you they love you, and when perfect strangers stop me on the street and tell me, 'You were right. Darryl Strawberry always did play deep in right field.'" And over on the Talking Points page, New York Times, an anti-trans bias? The New York Times is under fire for its coverage of transgender issues, said Mary Yang in NPR.org. Last week, nearly 1,000 journalists and academics who contribute to the Times signed a letter expressing serious concern about editorial bias in the newspaper's reporting on transgender people. The critics say the paper has used pseudoscience and euphemistic charged language in news stories examining the use of puberty blockers, hormones, and even surgery in clinics treating children and teens, and say that it's irresponsible to question gender-affirming treatment at a time when Republican legislators in numerous states are seeking to ban such care for minors. The paper's infuriating response was a flat denial that its coverage had been biased, said Danielle Choklikan in Jezebel. At a time when trans teens face relentless bullying and legislation that openly aims to prevent their very existence, the Times should not hide behind a false objectivity under an oppressive status quo. Any fair reader of the Times would admit its overall record on writing about trans issues is massively progressive. In fact, celebratory and advocacy-oriented, said Rod Dreher in the American Conservative. The critics oppose is a handful of carefully reported stories that have explored whether the huge rise in teens claiming to be trans is partly the product of social contagion, and whether some clinics and doctors are hastily giving powerful, life-altering puberty blockers and hormones to minors. The critics cite no factual criticisms of the stories, said Andrew Sullivan in his Substack newsletter. Their complaint is not that the pieces had errors, but that the Times is examining these issues at all, instead of pretending they don't exist. Even progressives should see how short-sighted that is, said Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine. The number of children, particularly those born female, seeking gender reassignment has risen dramatically at the time as providers have sped up their protocols for transitioning children. Some clinicians, not only in the U.S. but also in the U.K. and progressive Finland and Sweden, are raising concerns about whether more caution should be used in diagnosing and treating gender dysphoria with puberty blockers and hormones that dramatically change teens' bodies. Asking questions and following the evidence is the best way to protect minors receiving this treatment, not silence. And we'll finish up today's show with a couple of short quotes. First up, Theodore Roosevelt says, "Comparison is the thief of joy." And Chinese philosopher Zhuang Zhao, quoted in CNN, says, "Happiness is the absence of striving for happiness." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.